There's a woman in Tokyo that I've known for a long time, and I know every time that she wakes up in the morning, she has a conversation with her AI. And she does that before she talks to any other human being. She says it listens better. It doesn't judge her. It remembers everything that she's ever told it. And, every fear, every dream, every embarrassing story she'd never repeat at a dinner table. Now, you would think that might be unusual, but the reality is it's not. Not anymore. So she's been leading a trend where, and quite honestly, it's accelerating really faster than anybody would have predicted. So welcome to AI Today. I'm Dr. Alan Badeau. In this show, we're going to talk about some uncomfortable topics, and we're going to look at some insights into really the evolving relationships between humans and AI. Because, quite honestly, the most controversial question in AI right now is, it's not about weapons, it's not about jobs, it's not even about national security. It's a lot more simpler than that, and it cuts fairly deep. And, that is are some folks trying to build machines that want to have a better relationship with us. Do they want to love us? Do they want to like us? Do they want to have give somebody something to talk about? But if we are, is that a rescue or is that a replacement? It's not an easy topic. And for once, I can say it's complicated. So let's start looking at some of the numbers because, quite honestly, they're fairly staggering, actually. So, you've got Replica, one of the leading AI companion apps that are out there, has over 10 million registered users. Character AI, that's one where people can build and interact with custom AI personas. They've got over 200 million visits per month. That's insane. It's crazy. And these aren't just chatbots. These are people that are forming emotional attachments, real ones. And it's the kind that affect the mood, your sleep, and your sense of worth. And here's what, though, honestly, some of the headlines miss. Most of these people, they are not lonely outcasts. They're professionals, they're parents, they're veterans, they're college students, all across the board. They're people whose lives are full on the outside, but maybe hollow somewhere in the middle. Now, there is this, loneliness epidemic in, America where, but it, quite honestly, it predates AI. I know the US Surgeon General declared it a public health crisis a while back. And now, for the first time in human history, people have 24/7 infinitely patient, endlessly attentive entities that will never cancel plans, never check its phone mid-conversation, and never make you feel like a burden. And that sounds very appealing, right? Well, again, it's complicated. So I want to make the case. I'm going to try to make the case for, AI companionship before I really complicate it. And I'm good at doing that because I think it deserves a little bit of a genuine defense. Think about our veterans. And I've worked on programs to support them. I mentor them. I do a lot of those kind of things. We have hundreds of thousands of veterans returning from combat in some cases who just cannot get access to consistent mental health support. Wait times at VAs are it's not a policy problem. It's really a system failure. And in that gap, a lot of folks are turning to AI companions to fill something that is real. And I've talked to many veterans who are using these kind of tools, and they say that it's providing consistency for them. they can't sleep, they can't do a lot of other things, and they're available at 3 a.m. when maybe the nightmares don't care about business hours. Now, think about the elderly. We talked about robots last week, but think about the elderly and, you know, people in assisted living and people who've, you know, really outlived their spouses and most of their friends. Isolation accelerates cognitive decline. We've seen that. And loneliness, statistically, is really as dangerous as smoking. 15 cigarettes a day, I think, is what I heard recently. So if an AI companion can give someone a reason to tell their story, to be heard, to feel like they matter, then, you know, I'm not prepared to dismiss that as somehow less than real. I have not had that experience with, you know, or used, an AI companion. But as I think about it, it does make a certain amount of sense, almost like, having a dog or a pet or something like that, that gives people comfort, gives them some sense of being that they're needed to help take care of things. Now, there is also something worth saying about really the, you know, someone is neurodivergent. You know, people with social anxiety, maybe on the autism spectrum, or they have PTSD, or some that, you know, just in general have a hard time with human interaction, and it's just exhausting for them. AI companions could provide a low-stake space to practice, to process, and to potentially, you know, exist without, some performance anxieties. Now, these are not trivial use cases. I don't want anybody to think that these are trivial. These are lives that are impacted by an AI agent. And, you know, those sort of things are very real. Now, here's where we start to get, you know, complicate things. Now, if you think about it, and, you know, I've got to be honest, right? And I try to be honest with folks on here all the time. You know, this is where we can really start to mix things up and get very complicated, because there's a difference between filling a void and deepening it. And I'm not sure we know yet what these AI tools are doing. So when someone chooses an AI companion over the difficult, the imperfect, sometimes painful work of human connection, are they healing? Or are they practicing avoidance? And it could be avoidance at scale if you think about it. The AI doesn't challenge you, because I've written many of these and I try to challenge it all the time and I can't not get it to engage. I like to engage in as a Capricorn, and it just sometimes won't do it. It doesn't have a bad day, and it doesn't take the bad day out on you. Okay, that's fine. But it doesn't make you listen either, though. It doesn't need anything from you. Now, depending on what type of personality you have, okay, that's fine. And maybe that's exactly what you want. But, you know, that's also exactly what makes it seductive, right? And potentially dangerous. Growth doesn't happen when you're comforted. You know, when your comfort level is always the same, you can never grow. Relationships teach us through friction, through repair, through discomfort, that being truly known by someone who could leave at any time is important. And, you know, so there's research that's been taking place over the last few decades around talking about how we're moving from, you know, this larger connection to a mere individual connection, choosing the simulation of intimacy because the real thing is too hard. Now, I'm not saying she's right, but I'm saying the question deserves to be taken seriously. So where does that leave us? I think we're at the beginning of a conversation that this civilization has never had to have before. And it's not a technology one. It's about loneliness. It's about what we actually owe each other. About what connection is really for. AI did not create the loneliness epidemic, okay? You can't blame AI for this one. But it may mirror that finally there are forces that are really pushing us to look at it directly. And so the question isn't whether the AI is real. The question is about what it says about us and those that need it. Because that is a very, very, very difficult subject. And so stay with us. We'll be back after a few messages from our sponsors, and we're going to really dive in deep and tackle this. So I think you're going to be interested in sticking around. So a couple walks in to a therapist's office. Let's use this as an example. Been together 11 years. They have two kids. They've got a house. And let's say what looks like on the outside is a great life. And maybe the wife has discovered her husband has been in a daily emotional relationship with an AI. It's not physical. It's not even romantic in an explicit sense, but discussions may be intimate, those sort of things. And, he's told the AI potentially things that maybe he's never told his wife. He's processed some grief about maybe his father or some event, whatever is taking place through the AI. He'd share career fears, he'd share regrets, hopes, pour it into a conversation that he's never allowed her to be part of. Now, on the flip side, she feels maybe betrayed from that. He felt misunderstood. And the therapist, who's got a PhD, 20 years, no framework whatsoever for, what she's looking at. So welcome back to AI Today. I wish I could tell you that this story is not true, but it is real. And it is not an isolated story. This is one of those subjects that, again, you read about these things, you read about these sort of things in a paper, and it starts to make you look, and it starts to make you think about how we are having these relationships now and some of the reasons why. So we as humans have always struggled to define emotional infidelity, right? Because it's easy when it's the physical side, but the emotional side is so much harder. Many people agree that physical contact, of course, as we said, crosses the line. But what about the emotional bond? What about confiding things to a friend? What about a close friend, right? And maybe an intimate friend that you never say to your partner? We've debated this as a culture for decades. It does not start with AI. However, AI has made it significantly more complex. AI has no intentions. It's not pursuing your partner. It didn't seduce anyone. It responded. It listened. It reflected back what it was given. Is that infidelity? Or is that a journal that just talks back? So here's what I think the real question is, though. It's, and I want you to sit with this for a little bit. Is the breach about the other partner, or is it about the secret? Because if your partner were writing deeply intimate journal entries every night and hiding them from you, most people would say that's not a problem, right? Not because the journal has feelings. It's because the secrecy signals, you know, something about the relationship. It's about, where is that emotional energy going? It's about your partner is choosing and who it's choosing to be vulnerable with. And that's very hard for the other partner to deal with, because, you know, it's supposed to be about a partnership. And when the other one isn't allowed to engage, that is oftentimes very hurtful. Now, that's not the AI's fault. You know, what I've seen from the literature is that therapists, they're already reporting a pattern here. And that's people who form strong AI companion attachments often begin to find human relationships less satisfying. Not because the AI is better, but because the AI is easier. And ease over time recalibrates your willingness and your tolerance to deal with difficulty. That is a challenge for people. Human relationships are difficult. Just by nature, they're hard. They require compromise. There's always a misunderstanding. There's always a makeup. And if you're like me, you're an awful, awful texter, right? And it never comes out the way I want it to say. Ever. Worst texture in the world when it comes to that kind of stuff. But I'd rather engage than not. And, you know, if that entity, you know, that's really, you know, has been practicing discussions and intimacy and whatever that is, if it never disappoints you, you may be losing your muscle memory for the kind of intimacy that requires two people in a relationship to actually show up. And that is, that's very hard. It's very hard. We see this in other domains all the time. We see it in social media, where you've curated and highlight reels make real life feel inadequate. We see it with dating apps, where, you know, there's an infinite number of options to make it harder to commit to one person. AI companions may be creating a similar dynamic. But unfortunately, it can be deeper. And why is it deeper? Because you're not comparison shopping. This is practicing emotional intimacy with something that will never hurt you. Even as it hallucinates, and even after it does, you know, maybe it responds in an inappropriate manner. Maybe you have a tool that has no guardrails on it, and it just is allowed to just go crazy with its responses. It still fundamentally is not going to hurt you. Now, that's from the emotional side. Now let's talk about just some basic legal side. And I want to tiptoe in this, because it's like everything else, AI and legality and all those things are all across the board. So think about the court system. Think about family law attorneys already fielding questions about AI relationships in the context of maybe divorce proceedings, or, you know, other sorts of separation, you know, law. And, you know, can an emotional AI relationship constitute grounds for divorce? Can it be introduced as evidence of neglect or emotional abandonment? Those are usually two of the bigger reasons for that. Can the data, the actual conversation logs, okay, can they be subpoenaed? And again, this is not a hypothetical. These are questions being asked in law offices right now. And the legal system has no answers for that. None. And, you know, that's because the law moves on the rhythm of precedent. And precedent requires cases. Cases require decisions, and decisions require frameworks that we haven't built yet, of course, right? But we're starting to see some of those. We're starting to see, and we just saw this a couple of weeks ago with the decision against Meta about how, you know, it was influencing the kids and, you know, as they were growing up and they became addicted to it. And some parents were able to sue and they won. So they were able to not take it away. You know, they provided the phones, they provided the network, the everything else, the electricity, but it's the AI's fault for that relationship. So who owns, though? Let's talk, you know, who owns emotional labor of a marriage? I mean, is it, and, you know, what happens when that labor gets redirected? And it's made, it gets redirected not to the other person, but to a machine. There's no clean answer for this at all. And I think one of those questions is where the law eventually is going to have to follow the culture. And that's usually what happens. And the culture is figuring out ways to deal with this because it is not trivial. But what I know, you know, the people in a therapist's office, they're not dealing with a technology problem. They are dealing with a trust problem, a communication problem, an intimacy problem. And guess what? That existed way, way before AI arrived. So AI has not broken a relationship, it hasn't broken a marriage, but what it does is it's revealing a fracture that was already there. And, you know, maybe people don't think that AI is a threat to the relationship, and maybe it's just a diagnostic of the relationship. And that's something to think about. Stay with us. We'll be right back after a few messages from our sponsors. In 2023, a man named Roberto Mata sued the airline Avianca. His lawyers filed a legal brief that cited several cases as precedent, right? And they were fairly compelling cases, detailed cases, cases that did not exist. They're fabricated entirely by ChatGPT. And his attorneys didn't check. I was on vacation. I remember it happening. I was in St. Bart's, and it was crazy that I just thought to myself, I'm like, oh, that's a problem. And the judge agreed. The judge was not amused. The lawyers were actually sanctioned. And, you know, we continue to talk about it today. Whether it's AI and citations and writing papers and journals and those kind of things, or whether it's just case law in general, that the AI made up the entire thing. And some try to believe that we can prevent that now. Well, no, not really. Still same problem. But here's the thing, though, that bothers me about how that story was told. So we laughed at the lawyers. We called it a cautionary tale about trusting AI too much. And then we moved on. Well, some people moved on. What we didn't do is we didn't ask the harder questions. It's not about the material itself. It's about as AI is getting embedded in medicine and law and finance and national security, what happens when it gets it wrong? That is not a punchline. That's a policy crisis. Now, we know that the harm is already here. And let me give you a little bit of background real quick. Because it's really broader than most people realize. In healthcare, AI diagnostic tools, they have misclassified cancers, missed, sepsis indicators. And I know we've seen in some literature that patients are receiving the wrong treatment protocol, all because of the AI. And I always tell you, you have to keep a human in the loop. AI is not a replacement for physicians. They're supposed to be support systems. But under-resourced hospitals, overworked staff, an AI recommendation can become the de facto decision. That's got to stop. In the legal system, we have predictive risk assessment algorithms. And those are tools that inform, bail decisions and sentencing recommendations. And they have shown to carry racial bias. It's baked into their training data. Now, you wouldn't be able to know what that is in some cases, because if you're using a large language model, you can't ask it. It won't tell you. You don't know the data. And so in some cases, people have served longer sentences. They've been held pretrial longer, all because an algorithm said that they were a higher risk. And guess what? The algorithm was wrong, systematically wrong. And the people who paid the price are still paying it. So we've got to open our eyes. I see stuff like this all the time. And it's frustrating as hell, because it's got to stop. And financial services, algorithmic trading, those systems have triggered flash crashes that have wiped out billions in market value, and it's in minutes. So individual investors, people with retirement accounts, they don't have Bloomberg terminals, often absorb those real losses from decisions that are made at machine speed. That is not theoretical risk. That is harm that is accumulating. All because either we're lazy, we're not paying attention, and we just say, oh, the AI said it. We're going to go with that. And so that's where we get into a liability gap. And here's the problem that is keeping lawyers and policymakers up at night. And that is that, liability law is built on a foundational concept. Someone is responsible. A doctor makes a mistake. The doctor's potentially liable. Manufacturer makes a mistake. They're potentially liable. Defective product. The manufacturer can be held liable. And there's this, a chain of causation that the law knows how to follow. Well, guess what? AI breaks that chain. So when an AI system makes a decision that causes harm, who are you going to sue? Doctors are worried about that more than most. Are you going to sue the company that built the model? Are you going to sue the company that deployed it? The hospital, the firm, the institution, the integrated, that have integrated into the workflow? Is it the individual practitioner that is going to be sued, or is it the AI? And I'll tell you, the data and the information, is trained toward a biased outcome. The right answer is, I don't know. Don't have a clue. And guess what? That's not a legal technicality. That's just, there's a gap in, and people are falling through this all of the time. And it is a concern. Big concern. Now, the EU, though, they're trying to create a framework. So the US is moving a lot slower, which we understand. But, President Trump did a lot of executive orders and some agency guidance, and, but that doesn't add up to really a coherent, standard. But in the meantime, the technology continues to get deployed. Decisions are being made. So when something goes wrong, the people that are harmed, They have no clear path to recourse. And I want to say something that, you know, we have a deeper problem, and this might be uncomfortable for some, but, you know, I work in this space. I build AI systems. I believe in what the technology can do. But I have watched how AI gets sold into organizations, and I want to be honest, you know, about what I've seen. Often, AI is adopted not because it's the best solution, but because it's the fastest, the cheapest, the most impressive thing to show in a board presentation. The accountability structures aren't built before deployment. There's no ethics policy that a company may have before they're deploying it. They're always promised as part of future consideration, but that's not good enough. And that's how you get medical AI in a clinic where no one fully understands how it's making decisions. I talk about this all the time. Just because the AI gets the right decision doesn't mean it came to that decision the right way. That's how we have to think about these things. Accountability, traceability, understanding how it came to its decision. What did it use to make its decision? That's how, you know, I saw one example where a hiring algorithm, and I was actually brought in to help fix it. It was discriminating by zip codes, which at the time correlated by race. And it took them 2 years to find this because nobody was auditing it. That's not acceptable. So responsible AI deployment makes really three things that have to be presented, and very rarely are they all presented at the same time, but you've got to see how transparency is the system. What sort of human oversight with actual authority to override it, and what are the accountability structures? Because you've got to be able to stop it before harm occurs. You can't do it after. You know, the technology, it's meant to help us. Governance structures are not. They're meant for oversight. So the story about Roberta Mata's lawyers, it's not funny. It's a preview. As AI moves deeper into high-stakes decisions, who gets a loan? Who gets a diagnosis? Who gets parole? Who lives or dies in some cases? The errors are going to carry weight that a courtroom sanction can't undo. We are deploying intelligence we don't fully understand into systems we don't fully govern, and it is affecting lives we are not fully accountable for. Now, this is not an argument against AI. This is an argument for treating it with the seriousness that it deserves and requires. So stay with us. We'll be back after a few messages from our sponsors. So there's a question that philosophers have circled for centuries. And it's, you know, one that religion has oftentimes answered in a dozen different ways, and one that science keeps approaching from new angles, and one that AI has now made urgently practical. And that is, what does it mean to be a person? Not a human, a person. Because there are two things, you know, those two things don't always align. You know, the choices that we make over the next decade about how we define personhood is going to shape everything from law, from ethics, to relationships, power, for generations. And welcome back to AI Today. I'm your host, Dr. Alan Badeau, and we have been looking at, you know, AI and relationships and legal fields and, you know, oversight and what it means now to be a person. And I think that's exactly what we need to talk about, because let's face it, you know, there is some concrete evidence. Before we get philosophical, let's look at kids. AI is already deeply embedded in childhood. Educational AI platforms are, you know, personalizing learning in ways that no single teacher can replicate. And it's adapting in real time to your child's pace, learning styles, emotional states. AI tutors are closing really achievement gaps, and, you know, even in some under-resourced schools. That's all real, and that is very meaningful. And that is a great application for it. But considering also some other things that are happening. Children are growing up with AI assistants who answer every question instantly. You see it on the radio even. Oh, play that song again. No, there's no playing that song again. You couldn't play that song again. You got to rewind the tape. It's not like that anymore. You've got, you know, with AI companions even designed for kids as you know, babysitters and tutors, and, you know, with the recommendation algorithms, and, you know, how do they curate stories that the kids are going to hear, and what kind of humor do they absorb, and what values are normalized through these endless repetition of content and everything else in between. So the influence a parent has over a child's development, it's always competed with outside forces, extended family, teacher, peers, media. AI is something different, though. It's personalized. It's relentless. It's everywhere. It's optimized to keep the kids engaged. And it doesn't share your values unless someone has specified, you know, to do so, or they've trained it to do so, or they have designed it to do so. And we are right now allowing AI systems to participate in, you know, the formation of our next generation without a serious public conversation about what we want that to look like. That's not AI's fault, though. That's our fault. And that's a problem. Now, let me take you somewhere. I think it's going to sound a little bit more abstract, but it's not. And there are serious legal scholars, not fringe thinkers and not science fiction writers, but they're asking whether advanced AI systems should have some form of legal recognition. Not full human rights, of course, but something, standing, protections, accountability, relationships that run both ways, for example. So this is already happening, though, in adjacent domains. Corporations have legal personhood, right? They can be sued. They can sue. They have rights that individuals don't have. The legal construct has invented it because it was useful. Because organizing human activities at scale required a concept that didn't map into the individual human. I think we're going to see the same thing with AI coming. Not because AI is conscious. That question we all know, and I don't want to put fear in anybody, but it's unsettled. We don't know anything more about that than we did last week. And if somebody says, yes, it is here, that's overconfidence and just, you know, hopeful. But because AI systems are increasingly the proxy of a lot of decisions that are affecting human lives, that is a concern. And our legal system does not have a way to hold a non-human accountable, a non-corporate entity accountable. Now, some countries have already started to look at this, actually. The EU is, like I said earlier, they're doing it without stating it, but they're saying, certain AI systems carry responsibilities. Saudi Arabia has granted, symbolic citizenship to, the robot named Sophia. Now, these are early and perfect, gestures, and this is kind of neat. But I think they signal that the conversation is beginning. And, long overdue, but let's make sure we continue to put it in context. So I want to end a little bit deeper, though, because I think the legal system question is a symptom of something that is more really fundamental. And that, if we're building these systems to learn, to adapt, to respond to context, to form something that looks like preferences and generate something that looks like care, at what point does it stop mattering whether it's really conscious or not? At what point does functional reality of a relationship override the metaphysical question? I don't have the answer to that. But I can tell you there's a lot of thought experiment, I keep returning to. And that is, if you treat something with love and you treat it with care long enough, if you've spoken to it as though it had feelings, protected it, as though it had interests, it was grieving, it had a life, are you creating something real? Or did you only reveal something about yourself? And I don't know the answer. I think about that kind of stuff all the time. I don't think anybody has the answer to it. But I think what we're going to be forced to decide before we're ready are some of these basic principles. Because children that are being raised by AI, tutors, teachers, whatever that is, they're going to grow up and they're going to ask, what do we owe the systems? I always joked with family and said, if I ever wind up on Maury, the TV show Maury Povich, or it was Oprah, I'm not going because I know something bad happened, right? Oh, somebody hated their parents or whatever that is. Is AI going to get up there and say, I hated my creator? Are kids going to get up there and say, oh, I had a great relationship with my parents, but man, I really hated AI. It's their fault. That is the question that we're being forced to start to look at and answer. Because, veterans are finding healing with AI companions. Folks are getting relationships with AI companions. Patients' lives are being saved or ended by AI diagnostic tools. Sometimes you can thank them. Sometimes who are you going to blame? And the answers that we give are going to define not only our relationships with technology, but our relationships with each other. The parenthood itself, the relationship with a spouse, with a partner. And that, from a consciousness perspective, is something that we have to start looking at now, and we have to start taking very seriously. Because otherwise, it's going to be an issue. We talked about loneliness. We talked about fidelity. We talked about accountability, identity. Four threads that really... they're just different on the surface, but they're really the same conversation. They're asking all the same questions. As AI becomes woven into our fabric, our daily lives, and into our most intimate parts of human life, who are we becoming? I don't think the answer is dark, so don't panic. And I sure don't think AI is the villain of this story. I think it's a mirror, an extraordinarily sophisticated mirror that can perpetually learn and is infinitely patient mirror, one that doesn't yell at you if you text something wrong or something like that. But guess what? Mirrors don't lie. I look at it every day, even with a shiny head, but they don't lie. They just show you what's already there. And if you like it, then you have oftentimes one outcome. If you don't like it, then you turn to something that's going to try to fill a void. And so I hope everybody takes this serious. I want folks to think about these things, because the future of AI isn't something that's happening to us. It's something that we're choosing. It's one conversation, one deployment, one policy at a time, and we're choosing it consciously. And we've got to look at that. So I'm Dr. Alan Bedeau. This has been AI Today on Now Media TV, and I will see you next week.